This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, the first of a four-part series covering what has happened to this country since 9/11.
We will begin with the building blocks of a police state. What were the key legislative and executive orders put into place to really bring us to the dire state of liberty that we have today? A second piece that we'll cover today is what was going on in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. You all remember roundups of Muslims. And a third piece will cover the origins and the beginning of torture, how torture became open, public, and notorious in the United States.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since July 2004, Law and Disorder has brought Pacifica listeners the voices of activists, authors, and attorneys from the front lines. In the weeks to come, we will examine, in a four-part series, the foundation for what many see as a police state in the United States. In this series, we will talk with guests about the post-9/11 blueprint of this dictatorship police state and how the nefarious turned to war, the use of torture, and the domestic propagation of fear unfolded. Here at Law and Disorder, we four hosts know that topics such as torture, domestic surveillance, criminalizing dissent, racial profiling, and indefinite detentions are vital to bring an understanding to our listeners about how we have reached a police state. And in so understanding, where do we go now? This week, we will start with a look back at how the Patriot Act was pushed through the legislature immediately after the attacks on September 11. We examine racial profiling and the roundup of Muslims, as well as the rush to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, using the authorization for use of military force. Later in the series, we'll discuss the recent signing of the Military Commission Act of 2006 and the abolishment of habeas corpus. This, as well as the Insurrection Act and the buildup of detention prisons in the United States. The plans for a police state and martial law are slowly locking into place. Here on Law and Disorder, we examine this emergence and bring you voices of strength and opposition from activists, authors, and attorneys who are well-informed, not silent, and who are standing up against the strangling of democracy. The very reason our program Law and Disorder exists is because of what happened in this country and around the world after the events of 9/11.
At that time, anyway, Dahlia's moved to Washington, but we were all living in New York. Michael was actually jogging by the World Trade Center when it was hit by the first plane. I was supposed to be up on top of it having breakfast at 8 o'clock. A friend of mine canceled the breakfast, and I was actually in bed right across the street from the World Trade Center. The first plane that came over, that hit, came right over my bedroom. A whole apartment building shook. I went downstairs. My wife was saying, "What was that?" I said, "It had to be a car accident. What else could it be?" And I went downstairs, and I looked up, but a block away from where I live. And I looked up, and the top of that building was on flames. People were starting to gather in the street. More and more people came out. there were people screaming, it's going to fall down. So we all ran inside and we came out again. Then the second building was hit. We all ran back inside and then the sky got completely dark. It was like being inside of a refrigerator, nothing. And it lightened up again and everything was gray from the ash.
Adaya, where were you?
I was actually visiting my mother in California and woke up around 6 a.m., said I'm going downstairs to turn on the news. And I turned on the news and the first thing I saw was that first tower in flames.
And Heidi?
I was in the East Village, and a friend walked by and said a plane just crashed into the World Trade Center, and I thought he was joking, but then I looked up and I saw the smoke. So I went to a friend's top of the building, and we watched.
When I was jogging by, and we're not going to belabor this whole thing because we could probably talk the whole program about our first reactions, but I heard this huge explosion. I looked up, and that was the first tower after it was hit. And then I walked over, and you could see the exact outline of an airplane into the building. I mean, square. I mean, it just was right in it with the wings on the sides and the hole in the middle. And it looked like, obviously, it was an airplane. And we were so naive at the time, I was at least, that I saw another airplane about 15 or 20 minutes later coming up the Hudson and was flying very low. And I thought, well, it must be a plane that's going to drop water on the fire on the first building.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea. We had no idea. We thought it was a mistake by a pilot or maybe a suicide thing, but we had no sense that it could be terrorism. And then, of course, I saw the plane turn and fly right into the other World Trade Center.
That's funny you say that you had no sense that it could be terrorism, because when I saw that there was one tower in flames, the first thing that crossed my mind is, please do not let this be Muslims responsible.
Amazing, yeah. Guy. Interesting that you
thought
that.
It was just when Kennedy was killed, my first thought was, please let this not be a black man. Because you knew that somehow this government was going to use it against us.
That's interesting, Daya. But why did you have that reaction, Daya?
After Timothy McVeigh bombed the federal building in Oklahoma, they went out looking for Arabs and Muslims.
Yeah.
And, after the 93 World Trade Center incident, it was very hard for many Muslims across the country who had nothing to do with it. And so that was often my first reaction whenever you saw some kind of catastrophe, an act of political violence and bombing and killing of a mass number of innocent civilians was, oh, please do not let this be the work of Muslims, because the rest of Muslims will have to suffer.
Well, today we're going to talk some about that for sure. I mean, yeah, that is what happened.
There was no way any of us could have imagined the magnitude and the depths of depravity and the mass wholesale slaughter that this government has undertook in the name of keeping us safe from terrorism after 9/11.
Now, there were many events going on. I mean, some of them we'll get to at the Center for Constitutional Rights, at the ACLU, at Amnesty, at the Guild, with regard to roundups, and we'll talk about that. But let's look at sort of the blueprint of the structure, because one of the first things that I think that I know I saw with Michael Smith and a friend of ours at his house, we saw the president's speech. I don't know, Dolly, if you saw that as well, or Heidi?
Yes.
And what was your reaction, Daya?
Oh, gosh, who can remember at that time? I mean, aside from thinking this is the exact wrong reaction, the language was full of vindictiveness and not, we're going to do everything we can to keep ourselves safe and we're going to find out what happened. It wasn't talking about finding out what happened and taking care of people. It was about going out and getting revenge. It sounded very immature, very reactionary, and certain to rain further hate on us from around the world.
Also, I think the government didn't address the fact that this was a criminal act done by, a few people. It wasn't an entire country coming after us. We went into sort of war mode and really never focused on investigating and calling it just a criminal action.
I think you put your finger on really, if we look at the next 5 years, that's the issue. Had we gone after the people who did it as criminals, as a crime against humanity, whatever you want to call it, we would have been a lot better off than we are today. What that speech reflected to me was, as Daya said, we're going to war, and we're essentially going to war. I don't know if it's that speech or within that next couple of days that the president used the word crusade, which, of course, was quite reminiscent of Christians going against Muslims in the 10th, 11th, 12th century. And that's what we did. And we basically, because of that, in my view, spread U.S. terror around the world, which does not make us safer.
No, I'm not one that subscribes to the it was an inside job theory. But I do think that 9/11 gave Bush and the reactionaries in government, they gave them their program on a silver platter.
So we saw that speech. And then the next thing really, you guys may have some other thoughts, but the next thing that comes up here is the war against Afghanistan, which I think everybody here was not in favor of that war. Again, we wanted this looked at as a criminal act. But the key piece of legislation is the one that still dogs us today, that is still where the president claims that he has a huge source of power because Congress, he claims, gave it to him, and that's called the Authorization to Use Military Force. It's passed quickly by the Congress in September of 2001. It basically says that the president can use force against any nation, person, or organization who he believes had anything to do with the bombing of the World Trade Center. And, of course, the bombing of the terrorist act against the World Trade Center. And, of course, the president has expanded that to say any act of what he claims is terrorism. And he's expanded it also to say not only can I go after them, but I can wiretap people without warrants. I can hold people forever in detention. I can torture people. This basically was a blank check, which he's been struck down on. That, in my view, is the first big piece of the building block of a police state that this president got.
Yes, because the recent Military Commission Act of 2006 takes away habeas corpus for aliens, but it also says that if the president denominates somebody who's aiding and abetting terrorism, that person could be an American citizen, and it's goodbye.
And that's what this series is about. We're taking you from day one, 9/11, to where we are right now with the Military Commissions Act just recently having been signed into law. We're going to do this in a four-part series.
Now, these are the building blocks we're talking about, but of course, as you will hear as we go on, while these building blocks are being put in place, there are Muslims being rounded up, there's special registration, we'll be addressing that. But the next building block after the AUMF, the Authorization to Use Military Force, and of course the war in Afghanistan, that war is what I call the November 13th, 2001, I don't just call it that, the president called it that, Military Order Number One. Now, if you have to ask yourself what represents really a coup d'etat in the United States, it's that Military Order Number One.
Why do you think that?
It has two parts of it. It came out on November 13th. We looked at it in the paper on November 14th. It's that point when I really realized that we have something completely new and different on our hands. I mean, we were already going through the Muslim roundups, but at that point it was a grab for power. It did two things. It said the president had the authority to capture, detain any non-citizen anywhere in the world and hold them forever. And he could do it simply on his own say-so on the grounds that they were alleged terrorists. No trial, no kind of hearing, no habeas corpus, nothing. The president simply had to tell Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, pick up this person and hold them forever. That's part one of the military order. Part number two, which people focused on more interestingly then, was the special trials that the military order was going to give people if they got a trial. Those are called military commissions. And recall here, it says that only if they got a trial, they didn't have to get a trial, they could be held forever. But if they got a trial, they were to be basically given no trial at all. It was conceivable under this order at the time that a person could be tried completely in secret with coerced, tortured evidence and then executed at the end of the trial for an unspecified crime and tossed off the end of an aircraft carrier, and that would be, you never hear of the person. That was it. So you're talking really, when I talk about one single document, I mean the AUMF, the Authorization to Use Military Force, is one of the building blocks. This military order number one, issued by the president, is basically building block number two.
And is that still the law today, Michael?
Right now, that is still the law, except, of course, there's been, through litigation, some modification. We've done better. We got the Supreme Court in 2006 to say that you couldn't try people under these crazy military commissions in the same way with secret evidence, torture evidence, etc. But on the issue of indefinite detention, we're still facing it. We still have 460 people at Guantanamo, 500 at Bagram, and thousands, in Iraq. So we have not made a big dent on that. In fact, Congress has given, in some way, as we will hear, an imprimatur to enemy combatant definitions under the Military Commission Act. So that's building block number two. Heidi, number three.
Well, the Patriot Act has so dramatically affected all of our lives in a range of ways. What I think is interesting about this act is that the blueprint for this had been written years in advance. And as you said, the unfortunate events of 9/11 really gave our government a passport to go ahead and set in place an agenda that they clearly thought out carefully before. Patriot Act a large document that virtually no one read before passing it and was actually forced down the throats of many people, I think represents a lot of pre-planning for what the Bush administration, and probably going back to the Reagan administration, had wanted to set in place.
Congress was stampeded through fear into passing it without reading it. Congressmen's aides were calling up the ACLU afterwards to ask what they voted on, and it was rushed through Congress. In the Senate, for example, there were 99 senators that voted for it. Only Feingold of Wisconsin voted against it. Pattern almost as bad as in the House. Without having any chance to read, discuss, reflect, Congress, American people were saddled with the Patriot Act, which we're saddled with today.
There wasn't any time to read it, reflect on this. It was passed just 45 days after 9/11. On October 26, 2001. It is a 342-page document. It was printed in the middle of the night and passed without the usual hearings, without giving our representatives appropriate time to read it, to understand it, without giving people the ability to weigh in. And it did really some very significant things, like expanding terrorism laws to include domestic terrorism, which basically subjects political organizations to surveillance. And we're talking about wiretapping, we're talking about harassment, and they could face criminal action for normal, everyday political advocacy. It expanded the ability of law enforcement to conduct secret searches, and we saw this in places like Portland, Oregon, with the attorney Brandon Mayfield having FBI go in secretly into his home and take DNA samples, download the contents of his computer. It also, I mean, we're not just talking about going into your home or your office. We're talking about the power to go into your doctor's office, your psychologist's office, and get your files, get your financial files, all of those things with minimal judicial oversight, and unleash the FBI on American citizens and allows them to look into, investigate regular citizens without the probable cause that was needed in the past, so long as they say it's for intelligence purposes. That's really scary.
You know what's tricky about that one? That one really gets me that you mentioned that, Dahlia. You were working at the ACLU and the center. Yeah. We actually wrote a booklet about how that unlawfully expanded wiretapping against American citizens. So they put that into a statute, the Patriot Act, as you said. Meanwhile, something we don't know until, of course, recently, they were engaging in warrantless wiretapping of American citizens apart from the extra authority they'd already asked the government.
Yeah.
So we have our eyes on the wrong ball. They're doing something completely outside of the law they even asked Congress for, and boomo. And we're focused on writing about how unconstitutional that part of the law is.
And the other piece of it was the relaxing of the FBI guidelines.
Right.
The movement in the 60s was powerful enough to get the FBI out of our lives. You know, we used to say the police state is when the police can infiltrate your private organizations. Those are our organizations. This is supposed to be a democracy from the bottom up, not from the top down. And the cops were in all the various anti-war groups. They were on the campus. They were everywhere. We got them out of there. But those guidelines that kept them out of there were reversed. And now we've got them. And I'm sure that there are cops in every mosque in this country. There are cops in every peace group in this country. There are cops in every campus in this country from the various intelligence agencies. And that's been a sea change and a reversal of our victories from the movement of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. One last thing about the Patriot Act. If you weren't living in an area where you saw non-citizens, immigrants rounded up, questioned, detained, deported in the middle of the night, and you had no idea, this was the first indication of how non-citizens were to be treated, and especially Arabs and Muslims were to be treated in this country, because the Patriot Act allowed people who were not U.S. citizens to be jailed just on mere suspicion for basically engaging in free speech that the government did not like, and they could be denied readmission to the U.S. for engaging in this free speech. The detention could be up to 6 months, I think, just without any charges, unlawfully detained for 6 months. And that was a very scary thing because it told non-citizens that we're creating this completely separate track for you, and the Constitution does not apply.
I think the last building block I want to talk about, and just very briefly, are now we, of course, know that there were certain secret memos being written during this period about detentions and tortures and all that. But there was one that came out publicly, and that was the February 7th, 2002 presidential declaration, essentially, that the Geneva Conventions could be dispensed with, that al-Qaeda was not to be protected at all by Geneva, and while that Geneva might apply to Afghanistan in some way, that none of the Taliban fighters were to be protected by Geneva, that yes, the U.S. would apply Geneva as it wanted to, but military necessity could override Geneva. Now, at the time, I remember when that happened, and actually, despite my dislike of Colin Powell in many different ways, he did come out strongly and say we should be applying Geneva. It's a bad idea not to.
Michael, explain what it means for Geneva to apply.
Yeah, I think that, right. It's what I thought then and what I think now. What I thought then was they weren't applying Geneva because Geneva requires that one, people have to be treated as prisoners of war first and only then given a hearing if you think they might not be, and then they can become non-prisoners of war and be treated not harshly, but be treated differently than all the privileges given a prisoner of war. So that was one reason they certainly didn't want to apply Geneva. A second reason was that Geneva said you have to have trials if you try somebody by regularly constituted tribunals. And what does that mean? That means regular courts. That means you don't make up the rules as the person goes along. So you can convict them based on a new set of rules. So that would have meant that the military commissions that they had wanted to have under military order number one, which we talked about, would have been out the window. So that's the second reason. But the one I didn't know at the time, the one I really realized only as we've read some of the later memos, Alberto Gonzalez and some lawyers in the administration that we'll talk about, was that they dispense with Geneva because they wanted to torture people and interrogate them with cruel and inhumane treatment. And they had to dispense with Geneva, in their view, because they couldn't torture people or use cruel and inhuman treatment on them without running afoul of U.S. law that made such treatment a war crime. And the war crimes under U.S. law had to do with violations of Geneva. So here's what they do. They say, well, we're not going to apply Geneva. Therefore, we're not going to be guilty of war crimes, and we can go ahead and torture people. So what was really going on February 7th was that they were going to be torturing people, and they did it so they could protect CIA and military people by saying, don't worry, you're not going to be prosecuted for this stuff. So serious, serious stuff we're talking about. This is by February 7th. Look what we got here. We got the president's speech on a crusades and all of that. You got the authorization to use military force. You have military order number one allowing indefinite detention. You have the Patriot Act, and then you have this memo dispensing with Geneva. I mean, if you're talking about a blueprint for a police state going forward and what unraveled in the next 4 or 5 years.
They had a bunch of those building blocks in place within 6 months after 9/11.
While government is setting and the administration is setting up these building blocks, bringing us closer and closer into an active police state, we were seeing on the ground some very scary developments. Immediately after 9/11, on that same day, we saw Arab and Muslim men, especially in the New York and New Jersey area, disappearing off the streets. So you can imagine being an Arab or a Muslim in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut. Suddenly your husband, your father, your brother, your son disappears. We had literally hundreds of people disappearing off the streets, and some of them disappeared on the day of 9/11 so that family members and friends thought that somehow their loved one had been at the World Trade Center and died mysteriously. Why they were there, they did not know, and how they got there, they weren't sure, but they knew that their husband or their family member had not come home that day. And it turned out many months later that we found out that the government had been holding these people there. So they were picking up people off the streets. And we got calls from women who said, some government agents stormed into our home today, this morning, 5 a.m., 4 a.m., in the middle of the night, and they took my husband in his pajamas, and we don't know where they took him, and we haven't heard from him since. That was a week ago. That was a month ago. Attorneys, especially immigration attorneys from all across the country, were flying around trying to locate their clients. I remember my friend Valerie, who is an immigration attorney in Southern California in Los Angeles, and she has a lot of Senegalese clients, trying to find some of her clients who just disappeared. And she spent a good deal of time in New York and New Jersey banging on the doors of jails, and the government would tell her, no, we don't have a person by that name here. Come to find out, months later, they had been lying. There was a communications blackout on all of these people until the middle of October.
At the Center for Constitutional Rights, the same thing happened. We would get a call from a Muslim family, where's my husband, where's my son? You would call an immigration hotline number and all this, and they would actually misdirect you to the wrong prison. Passaic or Brooklyn House, I mean, whatever it was, yeah. It was amazing.
Under this smokescreen, how many people do you estimate were rounded up right afterwards?
thousands. I mean, it's unfortunately, most of it happened in secret. People who had clients and they knew exactly where they were weren't able to get to them. Remember at the ACLU, one of our clients we were fairly certain was in a certain facility, and we kept pursuing that, trying to find him. And we're told again and again, no, he's not here. And we were there one day interviewing someone else. And while we were interviewing that person, Edwin, the paralegal for the Immigrant Rights Department of the ACLU, saw our client walking in the background.
And was your client a terrorist?
No, in fact...
Were any of these people terrorists?
Nobody's been convicted of any crime related to terrorism.
You know, the thousands of people picked up?
Well, the reason they were all picked up and deported in the middle of the night is most of them had minor immigration violations. So everything from having come here on a tourist visa and stayed, or being here on a student visa and not taking enough credits, or having not notified the INS within 10 days that they had moved.
That's the one that really got me, Dahlia. I remember the period. You know, you're supposed to, what is it, every 10, if you move, you have to, it's a 10-day rule or something?
Yes, if you move, you have to notify the INS within 10 days that you have moved. And if you have not done that, you become vulnerable to deportation. You lose your good status. You know, I remember Viet Dinh, one of the architects of the Patriot Act and a great defender, or a great early defender of the Bush administration's actions, arguing vehemently that, look, you're either in status or you're out. He loved to say, he thought it was very cute to say, it's like being pregnant. You either are or you aren't. That was quite misleading, especially because when you consider people float in and out of status all the time. I'll tell you, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, was out of status several times before he gained his permanent residency because he was working when he did not have a permit to work, and he received a salary.
Well, this was an excuse that they just used to round up Muslims.
It was absolutely an excuse. So they're picking up the guy who works at Dunkin' Donuts.
Part of what Dahlia is talking about here is these roundups, and then, of course, the center wound up representing some of these people, as did many other people around the country. But what happened in the prisons in the United States, but particularly in the New York area, was remarkable. First of all, people were all these non-citizens who supposedly were out of status in some way, were treated as if they were terrorists. And they were sometimes put into those three-piece suits, which are chained to the ankles, the arms, the hands,
and then
the waist and your arms. And then they were beaten. Oftentimes they were beaten in these prisons. They were certainly yelled tons of anti-Muslim names. You know, a horrendous, horrendous atmosphere.
You know, there was a T-shirt with an American flag hung up on the wall, and people were slammed right into that American flag, and there was blood on that shirt and on the wall. People were dragged on the floor by their chains and at a running pace slammed into walls. The treatment was really horrific.
It was really vengeance for 9/11 against a completely innocent crowd of people. I mean, it's remarkable, and obvious in
the way people were treated. They were called Osama bin Laden, that type of thing. But that treatment is no different from the message that the administration wanted people to have, because they were very specifically trying to identify young Muslims as responsible for 9/11 collectively. As everyone will remember, before DHS was organized or disorganized into being, we had Ashcroft was the head of the INS. DOJ oversaw the INS. Ashcroft instructed the INS to take the characteristics of the alleged hijackers. Early on, he did this. He said, okay, we're looking for young men from these countries with these types of visas who entered the United States between a similar period to these alleged hijackers. We want all of these people to be rounded up for questioning. And that happened pretty soon after 9/11, and thousands upon thousands of young Muslim men who were already viewed suspiciously by their coworkers found themselves visited by the FBI, whether it was at their home or their workplace. And FBI who said, we need to investigate you, we need to talk to you because we think this person might be involved in a terrorist plot. And they were talking to neighbors, they were talking to bosses, they were speaking with coworkers, and you can imagine in that atmosphere of great fear and suspicion what that did to these individual lives. And then, of course, we had special registration. It was known as the official name is the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, which basically said that certain Muslim men and boys, 16 and over, were required to be fingerprinted, photographed, and questioned if you were here on any type of visa, aside from an asylee or refugee type visa. So you had to go to these special registration facilities, and essentially what it was a roundup. After 9/11, the FBI started questioning Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians based on the idea that they were more likely to be criminals because of their religion and ethnicity. At the ACLU, I started representing individuals who were approached by the FBI for questioning, and this questioning was very, very aggressive at times. People did not feel like this was voluntary. They felt threatened, and it was incredibly intimidating. And so our next guest, Samina Sundas, is a Pakistani Muslim who helped her fellow Muslims and Pakistani Americans integrate into mainstream American society and suddenly found her role changing after 9/11, not helping people integrate, but just helping defend people from the intrusions of the American government into their ability to just live everyday lives here. Welcome, Samina Sundas, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Dalia.
Can you share with us a little bit about what your activities were in the community before 9/11 and how they changed once 9/11 happened?
Sure. I used to be a national coordinator for an organization called American Muslim Alliance, where we were empowering Muslims to take part in the local and federal level politics, making Muslims partners in the political arena. After 2 years, I stayed with that organization, but then I realized I was not satisfied. We are not heading anywhere because everybody is calling us terrorists. So it doesn't matter how good our candidates are. People were not ready to vote for Muslims.
So what did you do then?
So after that, I realized that what I need to do is go back and build a foundation with the mainstream, with my fellow Americans. So I founded the organization named American Muslim Voice. Our goal with that was to bridge the gap between all communities, and our mission is to protect and preserve civil liberties and constitutional rights for all.
And how did you do that?
We just partner with mainstream organizations, starting all the way from Amnesty International, National Lawyers Guild, Blue Triangle, American Friends Service, Global Exchange, Code Pink, and all the other immigrant organizations and the churches and schools. And we just really created a genuine coalition with these people where we were working together on issues like Patriot Act and INS Special Registration, Real ID Act, all kind of things that the government was sending it to us. We were just working together as one voice.
What about your activities once Special Registration was announced? You have a American Muslim Voice has a hotline. Had you set that hotline up specifically in response to special registration?
Yes, that hotline was set before I started American Muslim Voice because it was not founded at that time with the old organization I was with. But once I left, they couldn't maintain it, so I carried on that work. So the hotline was specifically set up for that reason, because we were receiving panicking calls from the community members who had no idea why they were just called in for this registration. They were getting rumors and information from other communities, like Japanese American communities, that they have been through the same thing. Before they were put in internment camps, registration was the first thing that came to their community too. So that was really creating a panic in the Muslim community. So we decided that we will just do that in order to help these people understand what are the requirements, who has to go, and why is it important that they do follow the law.
Samina, what's your feeling about the success of the Bush administration in stigmatizing Muslims and scaring American people into thinking that somehow Muslims had something to do with 9/11? And the second part of my question is, this has been successful in terms of keeping the kind of patriotic fervor up in support of the war in Iraq?
I think Bush administration has done a marvelous job scaring my fellow Americans of Muslims. And they have created a culture of anger, hate, division, frustration, all that to achieve their political goals. And they have done it, in this last election. Their whole strategy was just keep people scared of Muslims. I witnessed that. I went to Gainesville, Florida, just to make sure that the wrong we did in 2000 election by, endorsing Bush, we righted. But the fear level in people was just tremendous. And they didn't understand that they were voting against their own interests just because of that fear and what Bush administration has done.
Let me ask you a word about special registration. Can you describe what it was and when it occurred and what some of the effects were?
Yeah, it occurred right after, you know, Patriot Act. That was the first hands-on kind of thing that came to Muslim community. And since I'm not an attorney, I had to go to visit San Francisco office. At that time, it was INS office, to understand what is happening and why they're doing it. They told me that they were doing that because USA did not have a very good exiting, you know, policy. So they are trying to track people, where they're going, when they're leaving the country. I said, you know, I have been in America for over 20 years. I do know that everything we do alphabetically. So why is it that we're picking on just the Muslim countries? I was told because Muslim countries, these countries have been labeled as the terrorist countries. And I asked them again, I said, there has never been a history that these countries ever attacked USA. They might be killing each other, you know, but they are not attacking USA. We are in no danger. But they said, well, this is what we are doing. And then I was getting calls from the community all over the USA. People were concerned somebody's son is in the wheelchair. He has been shot in the head. That person is no threat to himself, let alone the whole country. What we're trying to do is just really gather on the peace building. Our most offered forums right now are just, you know, to dispel the misconception about Islam and Muslims, because we believe it's the education that is going to just change anything. So we hold open houses in our homes. AMV members do that in their homes, not in the masajid, not in the community center, but in our home, to open up to our fellow Americans. And we are encouraging our fellow Americans to do the same. So you invite your neighbors, because our safety and security depends on how much we know about each other, not how much power and hate we can spread.
What has your experience been with the FBI targeting individuals, specifically FBI questioning of Muslims?
Well, Lodi case is the biggest example. When four people were arrested, and it was created such a huge, you know, drama that, you know, a terrorist in a Lodi, California. And 2 days later, they changed a lot of the statement. But the problem is, the impression of Muslims in the public eye doesn't change just because they changed, you know, their statements and all that 2 days later. They created such image of Muslims being terrorists that till this day, even though two of the people were let go by the FBI and they were deported on minor visa violations, the rest of the world thinks that all these people were terrorists. Therefore, every Muslim is looked upon as terrorist, and I think that is so horrible and such disgrace to our political and our, you know, constitutional rights and everything. This land is supposed to be home for all, and it doesn't feel that way. We don't feel welcome in this country because there is so much going on, so much garbage that is sent to Muslims, that, you know, every Muslim is a terrorist, every Muslim is a bad person. I was told in one of the radio shows, if I'm not a terrorist now, that, you know, I have the potential to be a terrorist. How do you answer that?
You answered an injury to one is an injury to all. You have our total support and solidarity, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
That was Samina Sundas of American Muslim Voice. You can listen to her story on the feature Tracked in America. Go to our website, lawanddisorder.org, to listen to Samina's story.
We want to bring you some of the underpinnings of the use of torture by the Pentagon and by the CIA. Who were the key players? What were some of the key documents? And what did they authorize? For this segment, we interview Scott Horton, an attorney in New York City, who is the chair of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association, as well as an adjunct professor of law at Columbia, where he actually teaches a course in post-9/11, focusing on torture. Scott, yeah. Welcome to Law and Disorder. We're really glad to have you. I know you're like one of the, probably the world's expert minutes on the timeline of torture in the United States. So why don't we start? What's your thinking? We're trying to get a reprise of how we got to where we are now, where really we have a vice president of torture and where our country is sadly deeply engaged in abuse.
Well, we have a couple of different lines that went on in internal discussion within the administration. And I've spent, you know, more than 2 years interviewing and talking to people, trying to figure out what the internal decisions were, how they were made, how they were sequenced, which people drove them. I think we had a, we had an attitude expressed very, very early on after 9/11. Actually, it was there even before 9/11 of rejecting the international legal order. I mean, a view that it was a straitjacket. The United States had emerged as the paramount military power in the world. This entire international legal edifice, which largely had been created by the United States, largely after World War II, was a constraint that didn't serve national interests. And if you go back and you look at the special study that Rumsfeld and Cheney participated in, the New American Century Study, you'll see that this is an underlying theme there.
Now, that was before 9/11. That's the
well before 9/11. Right. So this was, I'd say, an underlying theme even of the Bush campaign, you know, going into the 2000 election. And then we saw the first clear implementation of this right after 9/11 in connection with the plan for ground operations in Afghanistan. Now, you recall, of course, that that was viewed by international law scholars as a riposte, so it was something that was clearly authorized. There was an authorizing United Nations resolution. But for the first time in modern U.S. history, the U.S. went into Afghanistan without a clear declaration of the applicability of the Geneva Conventions. And that's something that had been pushed by what I call some of these radicals within the administration. And certainly the radicals included at that point John Yoo, David Addington, and they won over Alberto Gonzalez, who was not a person who up to that point really had had any engagement in international issues.
Those are three of the lawyers you mentioned. Addington is Cheney's lawyer?
And is right now is chief of staff. John Yoo, a very young fellow, a professor at Berkeley, surprising as that may be, and Alberto Gonzalez was the president's personal lawyer. So they basically wanted to push international law into the margins and going in. Now, of course, that's a different issue from the positive agenda of introducing highly coercive interrogation techniques, including torture. There, most of the public discussion and most of the documents we've seen have focused on the introduction of these harsh interrogation techniques in the military environment. But if we're really going to take a pure chronological approach here, it's very, very clear that it starts on the other side of the board in Washington. That is, it's not the military, it's the intelligence community, and particularly the CIA where this is starting. So very, very shortly after 9/11, Vice President Cheney personally is pursuing war on terror issues at the CIA. In fact, he's going over there regularly.
So this would be 2000, and this is 2002?
This is very early in 2002, even in the late days of 2001 after 9/11. And we know he has a multi-point agenda there within the CIA, and it included, certainly he was fishing for justification for a military invasion of Iraq. That was high up on the agenda. But beyond that, he also, in a number of conversations he has with senior CIA personnel, he's expressing his concern that interrogation techniques that are used by the agency are not sufficiently robust. And he continually makes allusions to practices used by, quote, our Middle Eastern friends.
Amazing. Now, by this time, they already have some people in custody?
They certainly have some people in custody through police actions. But, of course, we're looking in the beginning of Afghanistan into many, many more people taken into custody. So that's very, very late in 2001 and beginning of 2002.
He said, let's look at what our Middle Eastern friends do, I guess is where you
exactly.
left you.
Exactly. He says they're much more effective, they use more aggressive techniques, and they work.
Are some of the same techniques that the State Department reports.
There's a review within the CIA at this point that involves, you know, senior officers and the legal staff of the CIA, including Scott Mueller, who's the general counsel at this point. And this review says, no. What we're doing right now goes all the way up to the line of what we are lawfully permitted to do. So, you know, he's rebuffed in these overtures by the CIA, and Cheney does not accept this. He goes back to the White House. He has a meeting with Addington. Addington very quickly involves Alberto Gonzalez in the process, and they're basically focused on one thing, how to overcome the obstruction from within the CIA.
Now, this is the summer of 2002?
Even earlier than that, and it goes even back into the spring of 2002.
Scott, what techniques are they advocating for?
I do not know in great detail what these techniques are. I know that there are documents that were prepared about this time that do talk about the techniques. And in fact, I know that by the end of 2002, there's a major memorandum prepared within the Department of Justice that talks about them. But my conjecture, based on things I have been told, is that certainly waterboarding is on the list, very high up the list. Long-time standing, hypothermia, long-term sleep deprivation are also definitely techniques that are being discussed as part of this packet. But that's not all. There's a considerably longer list than this.
Scott, can you tell people what waterboarding looks like, what hypothermia, forcing hypothermia looks like, that type of thing?
Well, waterboarding comes close to being the stereotype of torture. When you say the word torture today, most people will think of woodcuts coming from the late Middle Ages in Europe, from the age, say, of the Spanish Inquisition. And indeed, in the Spanish Inquisition, Tomas de Torquemada, the great torture master there, had one technique that he loved above all others, and that was waterboarding.
Now we're somewhere in 2002 with Cheney, Addington trying to overcome what they consider to be resistance at the CIA and trying to say, we still want to do this.
Well, Addington, of course, being a bureaucratic genius, says, the easy way to do this is to have a memorandum issued by the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice. That then will be under the Judiciary Act of 1789. That then is a binding legal opinion for the government, and Scott Mueller and these other people at the CIA will have to just recede. They'll have to accept this view. So this is a way of cramming it down their throats, even though they oppose it. So that is then the genesis of the famous U-Bibee torture memorandum. It's being done to overcome a negative decision at the CIA to force this down their throats. And Alberto Gonzalez becomes deeply involved in this. Alberto Gonzalez, throughout this process, plays the position, essentially, the station master, you know, telling which trains to move where all the time.
Now, at that point, Gonzalez is the president's counsel. Of course, he's now our attorney general.
That's correct.
And that memo is the one that is the one of August 1st, 2002, right?
That's correct.
And the key aspects are that, two or three key aspects?
Well, I'd say, you know, the key aspects are the definition of torture itself and the idea of completely expansive executive power. And I would say, you know, just stepping back, under the legal reasoning of that memorandum, Saddam Hussein never tortured anyone. Because if the president authorizes it, it's not torture. And then a definition of torture that is introduced using reference to, say, medical triage statutes and things of this sort that, you know, were never intended to give guidance to torture, that open things up for brutal assault and physical contact, cruelty.
Right, that's the famous, it has to be the equivalent of organ failure kind of stuff.
Exactly, and I would say, you know, it's completely ignorant of the basic law, the legislative history, the preparatory works of the international law, but it's also completely ignorant of basic knowledge about medicine. They've not talked to anybody who had real knowledge about these areas of law. For instance, the JAG officers or the Department of State lawyers who know these things inside out. They've also not even talked to their own criminal division lawyers who would tell them you could never justify things the way you've justified them.
Let me ask a question about this, and then I want you to continue on the timeline, but I know the two lawyers who wrote this were Bibee, who I guess is at the Office of Legal Counsel, and his assistant, you, were at least the two key people. Now, do you think when they wrote this memo, this August memo that really basically says, go get them, torture them, that they wrote this knowing that it was going to be used as something that would therefore justify torture?
Well, John Yoo has repeatedly and publicly stated that this was an intellectual exercise, and he had no knowledge whatsoever of its application in any specific circumstance. That's an absolute outrageous lie. I've been told directly that he was involved in discussions in the White House with Addington. with Jim Haynes, with Alberto Gonzalez. He was fully informed of the issues that were going on, of the effort to compel the CIA to use these aggressive techniques, and the fact that lawyers within the CIA had said, no, we've gone far enough. And he understood that what he was doing was designed to create a legal cram down to overcome the objections that had been raised and to force through these highly aggressive techniques. And so I think there's no question but that he certainly understood everything that was going on. What I know much less of is the role of Jay Bybee, who's now a judge on the United States Court of Appeals.
Ninth Circuit,
yeah, he put it out.
Right. So what happens next? They get this memo written, and then what happens?
Then this memorandum is delivered to Alberto Gonzalez. It's delivered by Alberto Gonzalez then to the CIA, and they're told, you're overruled. So you're now going to begin introducing these practices. But there's further pushback that comes from the CIA. I mean, the CIA continues to say, look, we feel very uncomfortable with this. I mean, this is very vague guidance. We're quite concerned that if we follow this road, that individual career officers of the CIA may wind up being prosecuted for violating the anti-torture statute or other statutes. We're not satisfied with the U. Bybee memorandum. So following on that, there were further documents that were prepared, and these are documents now that I've heard described by many different sources, but I have not yet seen these documents, and they have not come into the public sector. But the documents include a memorandum that describes in some detail the new highly coercive techniques. And I'm told that Alice Fisher, who's currently the head of the criminal division, was involved in preparing that, as was Michael Chertoff, who's now the Secretary of Homeland Security.
You're not making us feel any better here, Scott.
they were involved in preparing this, and there was also, on top of this, another memorandum prepared that basically was a memorandum of agreement that was concluded this time with the Department of Defense and the CIA, saying, well, as long as your people are using the techniques that are described here, we are not going to be bringing any charges, and it's properly authorized. We're not going to be bringing any charges against them if the techniques result in someone dying or someone being maimed or injured.
So basically they authorized torture, and then they said, we're going to suspend the criminal law that makes you able to be prosecuted.
We will, right. Using the prosecutorial discretion vested in the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, we're telling you now we will not prosecute.
But right. It gets worse.
Let's think about it. Where are all these people being detained? The great bulk of them are in the custody of the Department of Defense.
Right, they're not at the CIA.
Right, so we have the CIA for the first time is operating black sites. Now, historically, the CIA was not a jailer. That was not their function. They didn't do that. And there, a lot of people in the agency hated the idea of them becoming a jailer. But nevertheless, these black sites were set up so the CIA would exercise custody and control over a limited number of people. Now, we're talking about, 100 to 200 people, not a large number. But the large numbers were in the custody of the Department of Defense. So even though the CIA was the first authorized to do these things, as far as I can see, on paper. Nevertheless, they were in the custody of the military. So the CIA interrogators were going and visiting them at military sites, which included, for instance, Guantanamo or Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan or other sites, quite a few of them, in fact. This means that military officers, military interrogators were observing this and were wondering, what the hell is this going on?
Right, because they were seeing the CIA people carry out techniques that are not allowed by the Army Field Manual. That's all really 2002, which is really not only setting the stage, because it's obviously the heavy use of these techniques. Can you just jump ahead in our last couple of questions for where are we today right now with both CIA using these kind of techniques and really the Department of Defense using these kind of techniques? Where do we stand?
With respect to the regular uniformed services in the Department of Defense, we have a new field manual that's out, which is, in my view, clean. So it's gone back to, I think, tried and proven techniques, which I consider to be consistent with Geneva and Common Article 3 standards.
That is, I guess, where it stands. Although, when I read they basically amended the criminal statute, the war crime statute, to somewhat narrowly defined torture again, with intent requirements and stuff like that, along with cruel treatment. So I guess they would argue they still have an argument on this.
Well, they didn't do their work very carefully, because there are at least four other statutes that cover this that they didn't amend.
Well, Scott, this was an incredible interview. I mean, really, it really took us through it, and we really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Great, thanks.
Hi, Scott.
Scott.
Bye. Thanks, Scott.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York. Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta, me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta, bam, bam, para cumplir con la meta, bam, bam, de mi pequeña labor. A caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo. Bien.